Ladies, gentlemen, students, welcome to the LSE for this evening's event. My name is Jürgen Harker. I'm the director of the Salisbury Hawk Southeast Asia Center here at the LSE. And I'm very, very pleased to be here tonight to welcome Professor Mark Thompson. Professor Thompson directs the Southeast Asia Research Center at the City University of Hong Kong. He's also the current head of the Department for Asian and International Studies. Previously, he taught in Germany and the UK. And Professor Thompson is famous for his studies in relation to democratic struggles and the nature of political systems in Southeast Asia. He has a long-standing interest in Philippine politics. I think even if there was only limited interest in the UK about politics in the Philippines, this surely would have ended with the election of Rodrigo Duterte as president earlier this year. Described by some as a crime-busting strongman, President Duterte has pursued a highly controversial campaign against drugs. Also, the president has reiterated his desire for an independent foreign policy that would involve, quote, separation from America, which has stunned many. President Obama has called his counterpart a colorful guy, quote. I'm happy to say that we will rely on Professor Thompson to discuss the political developments in the Philippines under the new president and to explain how we got to where we are now. For those Twitter users among you in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Philippines. I would ask you that you please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded by the Southeast Asia Center, and we will hopefully be able to make it available as a podcast, subject to there being no technical difficulties. And I ask you that you do not use any recording equipment yourself. As usual, after the lecture, there will be a chance for you to put your questions to the speaker. But now, will you please join me in welcoming to LSE Professor Thompson to deliver his talk entitled Duterte's Bloody Democracy in the Philippines.
Thank you very much, Jürgen, for those kind words, and welcome to everybody here. I'm sorry that the space is not adequate, and we have quite a few listeners outside of the door for health and safety reasons, but I'll do my best to speak up. Can you hear me in the back? I am. I'm using the mic. Can you hear me now? Okay, lean into the mic. That's the... And I'm going to actually move over here to do the PowerPoint slides. What I was just going to say is I will go through others. Okay, here we go. It's better. A mic without a light, always a bad sign. I'll go through the slides. I have a few charts I want to show you, but I think we should have time for some questions. It seems like there's quite a bit of interest in this topic. And after having been a student of Philippine politics for 30 years, I'd like to say I'm happy for this interest, but perhaps it's to some extent for the wrong reason.
Okay. Now, I have no green light here is the problem.
I just tried.
Testing. Is this working? Okay, can you hear me in the back? No. Okay. Leaning as far as I can into the mic here. Okay, so I think the title of this talk is fairly self-evident. And the background of what I'm talking about is, in a sense, the burial of what in the Philippines is known as EDSA. The EDSA uprising, many of you here will know it as People Power. Hard to believe, 3 decades ago, actually almost exactly 30 years ago, 30 and a half years ago now, the Philippines impressed the world with a peaceful uprising against a dictator. So the Filipinos, brave and courageous and democratically minded, removed a corrupt dictator. Now, 30 years later, it looks like the opposite is occurring. After the transition from dictatorship to liberal electoralism, now we have a president who has a neo-authoritarian narrative. I should stress that the Philippines is not a dictatorship, and we'll need to talk about what kind of regime it actually is. But there's clearly nostalgia for Marcos, who Duterte himself called the greatest president. And as some of you will know, there's discussion Duterte wants Marcos to have a hero's burial. The Supreme Court will decide about this very soon. But I would argue this is the symbolic burial of what can be described as liberal reformism in the Philippines. And illiberalism has been raised from the grave 3 decades later. So what is it that's been born or reborn or risen up and during the night? It's still, as I said, formally democratic, but very bloody. And here is an important abbreviation that Filipinos know about. It's EJDs, extrajudicial killings. And the last figure I've seen is we now have 4,500 people dead in the first 117 days of Duterte's presidency. For those of you who kept track of the Marcos dictatorship, at least in terms of extrajudicial killings, that already exceeds the number killed in a decade and a half of dictatorship. So egregious human rights violations. Interestingly, however, we have a president with a similar reformist agenda to Aquino, his predecessor, Noynoy Aquino, the son of the former president Cory Aquino, who passed away in 2009, but also the son of the assassinated senator Ninoy Aquino, whose murder assassination in 1983 set off the events that eventually resulted in the overthrow of Marcos, People Power, and EDSA. The same basic reformist agenda, but absent, no longer including liberalism, with a tough guy Duterte to ensure its implementation, a greater emphasis on social policy, which is quite interesting, but at the same time more of a neoliberal focus on economics. Another important thing that he's promising is more federalism, a French-style constitutional change, and of course, as Jürgen already mentioned, a rebalancing, as some are calling it, vis-a-vis China, away from the U.S. Okay, so what I want to do is look at some of the existing explanations for the rise of Duterte and his time in power, his brief time in, as president. This is obviously a small literature. It's early days still, and it's an analytical distinction. There is actually some overlap in some of the authors I'm going to be discussing here. One explanation I'm going to look at is that Duterte is a typical right populist who's mobilized a mass constituency through the social media against drug criminals and a corrupt establishment. The second explanation is that Duterte's presidency is but the latest manifestation in a series of crises confronting what's termed oligarchic or even cacique democracy in the Philippines, amidst the profound social and economic inequality that still characterizes the lives of most Filipinos in that country. Okay, let's talk about right populism. Populism is a very slippery term, hard to define. A lot of academics have spent a lot of time, written many books, and have often emerged frustrated. What exactly is populism? Well, one thing that definitions of populism tend to share is an understanding that involves the people, vaguely defined but seen as simple and good, who are contrasted with a corrupt elite. Today's populists, however, are not necessarily explicitly anti-democratic, but as Jans Werner Müller has put it, they tend to be principled anti-pluralists. So they see the people as homogeneous. They don't understand or they don't accept the natural sort of heterogeneity that characterizes most populations. Then the distinction is made between left populism, so it'd be people like Bernie Sanders, Corbyn here in the UK, the Podemos movement in Spain, which taps into people's anger by appealing to their sense of social justice, and right populism, which appeals to people's fear and prejudices. And crucially, and this is the main point about right populism, involves an unhealthy coalition between hated elites who help marginal groups. And that's seen as something that's completely unacceptable. So Duterte has been classified by some authors as a right populist. How can this be? Because as many of you will know, Duterte has reached out to the left, and in particular the pro-communist left, the Communist Party of the Philippines, the New People's Army. He's released the leaders of the party captured over the years in an ongoing insurgency, declaring a ceasefire, offered cabinet positions, important cabinet positions, to key allies of these left groups. As we speak, there are negotiations going on in Oslo, Norway, to end this decade-long insurgency that goes back to the late 1960s, a Maoist insurgency. Duterte has also made positive signals on land reform and offering more social programs. So that doesn't sound very much like a right populist, if anything, more of a left one. But killing thousands of suspected drug dealers and users through so-called legitimate encounters with police, those who have actually looked into some of these killings would question that, about the legitimacy and whether the criminals are actually fighting back or whether these are just executions, and vigilantes, which again some research has begun to show are closely linked to the police. James Putzel of this university has spoken of a more virulent form of populism when describing Duterte. Another analyst, Nicole Corrato, speaks of, quote, the fantasy of penal populism, which involves a virtuous public versus the degenerates who do not deserve due process, the drug dealers, the criminals. They deserve nothing less than death. Okay, so what does this explanation explain? What doesn't it explain? Well, clearly it goes some distance toward helping us understand why Duterte is so popular. Why was he able to, as a late candidate, come from behind and win what was basically a landslide? It's a little bit complicated for those of you who know the Philippine electoral system, one of the least satisfactory electoral systems in the world, in my opinion, but nonetheless, within that kind of awkward system, a relatively clear victory, plurality more specifically. And now, of course, he enjoys, at least until recently, 90% approval in opinion poll ratings. So it's good with the emphasis on this kind of populist appeal. It seems to be effective in explaining that. But it also seems to explain too little in some ways. What actually are the underlying causes of Duterte's victory and his popularity, given, and this is what this chart here shows, that drugs and criminality, which Duterte focused on, were not really a major concern of Filipinos until Duterte himself comes along. So if you look at this chart, the green line in the middle shows you what Filipinos are concerned about, is, and this is the concern with fighting criminality. So basically, this is a lower level priority of Filipinos, starting going back to the 2014 polls until December 2015, when Duterte emerges as a candidate for president. Concern about criminality shoots up, and it becomes briefly the most pressing concern of Filipinos. But already by September, just last month, it had returned to a lower level priority. So how do we explain that? All of a sudden, Duterte comes along, and people think crime is the major issue, but that quickly dissolves into concern about other issues, such as, for example, controlling inflation or improving the pay of workers, things you might expect to be prioritized. And another puzzle is, why would Duterte be so successful when his predecessor, Benigno Noynoy Aquino III, was relatively popular? So here are all the post-Marcos presidents. This is a Social Weather Station poll. By the way, one thing about Philippine politics that's very useful is that there are two excellent polling agencies. One is the Social Weather Stations. The other is Pulse Asia. Easily accessed websites. This kind of information can be easily accessed. This shows net satisfaction ratings of presidents. You can see this pattern of high initial popularity declining. Aquino's popularity, this is Noynoy Aquino's popularity, also declines, but not as steadily, and actually recovers slightly, ending at a plus 29%, the highest of a post-Marcos president at the end of his or her term. So we have a relatively popular president who is a liberal reformist, I would argue, and yet he's succeeded by Duterte. Why is that? What are the underlying causes? That seems to be something that the populist explanation really doesn't get at satisfactorily. So we come to the second explanation, the crisis of oligarchic democracy. So this is described as the latest in a series of crises that the country has encountered. Eva Lota-Hedman has made this argument in a book that was published 10 years ago. Every decade or so, outsiders challenge the prevailing political order of what can be called direct oligarchic rule, sort of kind of indistinguishable kind of politicians. Aquino is a perfect example, comes from a hacienda-owning family, Hacienda Luisita, one of the largest and most exploitive plantations in the Philippines. So a typical, to use the words of Benedict Anderson, who just died last year, cacique democracy, the big landowners, the traditional elites, the oligarchs. Philippine economy is now much more complex, so we don't want to reduce it anymore to just the landowning elites. But that sort of symbolizes the kind of inequality, the almost feudal character of the country. And so what you get periodically are in grievances, tensions, conflicts building up within this kind of narrow elite rule. If you have a country that's governed by such a narrow group of elites, you're inevitably going to get outsiders who come along and voters finding them very appealing. Anderson, in his article, which is still worth having a look at, even though it dates to 1988, he says that it's actually less the Spanish period. So it's less the sort of Latin American style background of the Philippines that's relevant. Rather, it's U.S. colonialism, where land and other economic resources were concentrated into the hands of a small elite that at the same time were handed over political power through what Paredes has called a colonial democracy. Quite a remarkable experiment in electoral democracy during the colonial period. In few other places were elections so widespread under colonial rule, and yet it was local political dynasties, members of this narrow oligarchy, who were competing against each other for power, and that was the basis of the beginnings of cacique democracy, as Anderson argues. Moving on to the Marcos period and the post-Marcos era, Anderson argued Marcos was then the supreme cacique. You know, it's only a matter of time before this system of competing oligarchs who compete for political office and agree to compete in elections periodically, yielding to those who win if they're on the losing side, will end if somebody just puts an end to this system altogether. And that happened with Marcos, who won unprecedented re-election in 1969, many would say through fraudulent means. It certainly was an extremely expensive election that led to an economic crisis and a huge degree of opposition by other oligarchs, including Ninoy Aquino, the father of Noynoy Aquino. And this political crisis escalated into Marcos declaring martial law in 1972 that only ended with the ETSA uprising in 1986, which Hedman has described as a kind of transformismo where the elites rally. There's been a huge economic crisis, of course, sort of Greek-style economic crisis. The Philippines is doing relatively well economically, at least on paper, strong growth rates. That wasn't the case in the early 1980s when the economy suffered a major debt crisis, and with the assassination of Ninoy Aquino, loss of confidence, it turns out that the central bank had faked its figures, very similar to what occurred in Greece, and the Philippines had basically a lost decade economically, as well as political turmoil. And this was the background for the toppling of Marcos and the reinstallation of this electoral democratic cacique-style democracy, to use Anderson's terms. Then we go another 15 years ahead, 2001, and we have a popularly elected president, popular among the poor, Joseph Estrada, a movie star populist. He's toppled by elite opposition in 2001. His friend and fellow movie star, FBJ, then is cheated in the 2004 elections. I'll come back to that in just a second. So here comes Duterte now in 2016, posing as an anti-oligarchical candidate, railing against Imperial Manila, an old photo of Manila there before the destruction of World War II, railing against weak and corrupt elites in the context of a highly unequal society. So you see where this argument is going. This is just typical kind of crisis situation in an oligarchic democracy. And yet this too leaves certain things unexplained. Duterte himself actually is also an oligarch, although albeit from a lesser branch of the oligarchy, a local dynast. who divided up his cabinet positions in Davao after his victory in a typical strongman style. He's a former warlord mayor who's now mayor-president. I say mayor-president because he often mistakenly or perhaps intentionally calls himself mayor, even though he's now president. So he sort of treats the Philippines as his large city now, rather than just being mayor of Davao, he's mayor of the whole Philippines. Another important difference is, unlike in the 1950s, late 60s, mid-80s, and early 2000s, periods that Hedman refers to as crises, phases of crisis, there was no clear trigger for the current crisis that led to Duterte's election. There was no stolen election. Think of the snap elections in 1986 that led to Cory Aquino coming to power, or other forms of instability. There's no major communist insurgency, such as in the early 1950s, the so-called Hukbalahap insurgency, then later in the late 60s, the rise of the new Maoist insurgency, which was gaining momentum in the mid-1980s. There's also no major economic downturn, such as the economic crisis of the mid-80s, or even the Asian financial crisis that preceded Estrada's downfall. Furthermore, Duterte appeals most strongly to the middle class and not to the poor. So this is very important. So this is not somebody like Estrada who's making these pro-poor appeals. This is somebody who's appealing to the middle class. I think these figures are too small, but let me just read them out. So in the Philippines, voters are divided between so-called ABC voters. Those are anywhere from very elite to lower middle class. D are the poor, and E are the very poor, and those would be those Filipinos who suffer from at least partial hunger. So Duterte's support is disproportionately strong among the ABC voters, 46%. Among the poor voters, slightly higher than about his average, about 40%, what he got overall. And then it's lowest for the very poor voters. Now, this is not a huge difference, but if you look at some of the other candidates, there is an important difference where Binay, for example, the vice president under Aquino, who had this pro-poor appeal, his votes are greatest among the very poor Filipinos. And that's typical also of Estrada, who was supported to the very end by the poorest Filipinos. Okay, so given that problem with the second explanation, let me offer my own explanation, which in sort of a perhaps awkward academic style formulation I'm calling disjunctive liberal reformism. What I'm talking about here is the relationship Duterte has to an existing political order. And this is following the work of a U.S. political scientist, Stephen Scrane, who works on the U.S. presidency, but adapting it to the conditions of the Philippines. So what I'm talking about is each of these political orders has a kind of political narrative. There are powerful elite strategic groups that back this political order, and there are certain institutional arrangements. So what I would argue is post-Marcos presidents founded, reshaped, defended, but ultimately undermined a liberal reformist political order. And that's despite the fact that Aquino was personally popular. That the good governance claim, the key message of this reformist kind of political order, was contradicted by a pork barrel scandal that raged from 2013 to 2014. Here's a picture that shows you some of the protests. Youth Act Now against Aquino's pork barrel. So the great straight path reformist, as Aquino modestly called himself, was himself caught up in a huge pork barrel scandal. Add to that poor infrastructure. Those of you who have been recently to the Philippines will know traffic is still a nightmare in the major cities, particularly Manila, of course. Disaster management after the Haiyun typhoon, the number of houses built, the number of people really helped was shockingly low. There are a lot of, I think, fair critiques that have been made of the government for that. And there was also rising crime, not quite as dramatically as Duterte would have claimed, but the number of these factors come into to feed into Duterte's narrative and allow for a kind of illiberal rupture. Another important point is that the groups, the key strategic groups, as they can be called, that backed Aquino were weakening. And one of the most important groups is the Catholic Church. As you know, the Philippines is 85% Catholic. And it's common to say, well, the church basically is in charge. The church can condemn politicians it doesn't like. It clearly did that in the case of Estrada. calling Estrada immoral. He had a lot of mistresses that he provided lavish housing for, and this was used, among other things, also a gambling scandal, to portray Estrada as a morally unacceptable president. In the meantime, however, the church has had plenty of scandals of its own. For those of you who know the situation in Boston with the Catholic Church and sex scandals there, well, that's nothing compared to some of the things that we found out about the Philippines, and of course, there's still quite a bit that's been covered up. Duterte himself, interestingly, claims to have been sexually abused by a priest as a child. The Catholic Church was also hardline on a relatively mild contraception bill, the reproductive health bill. So the Catholic Church, of course, there's no divorce in the Philippines. It showed itself to be extremely, as more secularly minded Filipinos would say, unreasonable when it comes to issues of reproduction. And there's been growing fragmentation in the church since the death of the famous, or infamous, depending how you see it, Manila Archbishop Jaime Cardinal Sin, who was a very important leader of the church, particularly when going against Marcos in 86 or Estrada in 2001. So the church is weakened. Big business. Philippines is growing economically. You'd think big business would be strengthened, but recent evidence that wealth concentration is actually increasing, that 3/4 of recent economic growth in the Philippines went to the 40 top families, suggests that this growth is not being very equally distributed and that the Philippine economic system is somehow broke for the average Filipino, who benefits very little indeed despite these high growth rates. Military was humiliated by the loss of not the official, but the de facto loss of the Scarborough Shoal taken over by the Chinese in 2012. Social Democrats left civil society groups discredited for being so close to Aquino with the pork barrel scandal, opening space for the communist left. And, of course, the U.S., which has a lot of baggage because of the colonial past, most recently involved in anti-terrorism operations in Mindanao, which Duterte is very skeptical about, also backed Aquino's confrontational stance vis-a-vis the Chinese in the South China Sea, and that's also been put into question recently. Institutions turn out to be quite pliant. Congress, even though Duterte only had a handful of seats in his so-called political party, quickly switched over to his side, so-called Balambings in Tagalog, those who opportunistically switch political sides with parties being weak. The Supreme Court has hesitated to step in to limit Duterte's extrajudicial activities, and the police seem very gung-ho indeed. So what I'm arguing is Duterte has taken advantage of this disjunctive situation despite the growth and political stability, at least on the surface. Using a law and order narrative, building a new elite coalition, he's been able to carry out this murderous drug crackdown. Okay, I've got several more slides that I'm going to go over more quickly. This is just talking a little bit about the so-called EDSA regime, the liberal reformist regime, the sort of trust me, you can vote for me because I'm personally honest. That's what Cory said, of course, when she defeated Marcos. It's what her son Noynoy said. By the way, here's an interesting point. Many Filipinos will say dynasties are bad, right? Also in India, people say dynasties are bad. Interestingly, U.S. Democrats at the moment are not saying that because Clinton is okay. Trump is bad. But see, sometimes dynasts can be good. And turns out Noynoy Aquino was also a good dynast because, after all, his mother was good. So the dynastic element was quite interesting. Anyway, it was about the question of trust. So he, in a sense, inherited the charisma of his mother. She was good, so the son will also be good. He said his campaign slogan in 2010 was, if there's no corruption, there will be no poverty. There was, unfortunately, much corruption, and there's still quite a bit of poverty. These extra electoral groups I've already talked about, the big business, the Catholic Church, civil society, and the military, and, of course, institutionally relied on a free press. There was a certain degree of electoral democratic consolidation. And very important for the post-Marcos EDSA order, liberal reformist order, was macro financial stability. The Philippines is actually quite a remarkable developing country in that regard, compared to, say, Brazil or, of course, other BRICS, such as South Africa, that foreign investors praise, and these ratings agency praise, the strong macroeconomic foundations. And this is basically a legacy of this huge financial crisis, which I talked about earlier, the 1980s. And it's also been one of the basis for this rapid economic growth, albeit quite unequal. But the weaknesses, government efficiency, infrastructural problems, and, of course, crucially, the ETSA regime was never set up to enhance popular participation. It was set up, actually, to increase reform. The problem with dictatorship was it was corrupt. Marcos had cronies. So why electoral democracy? Not to actually empower ordinary people. It was to push through reformism. The result was, of course, something that was quite vulnerable then to a legitimacy crisis should the sense arise that real reforms are not taking place, particularly if growth was exclusive. There was social neglect, neglect of social programs under Cory Aquino, under Ramos. People underestimate how much Estrada was actually trying to do in his only 3 years in office. But, of course, he was overthrown. The presidency of Arroyo was one beset by legitimacy crisis. And already when Noynoy Aquino comes to power, reformism was weakened. Growth without major poverty reduction, there was a bit toward the end. But still not as significant as you would guess given these high growth rates. The pork barrel scandal despite the so-called straight path. There seemed to be a lot of moralizing going on, but not really too many major institutionalized political reforms. Okay, let me talk briefly about the election of last May. Kind of an interesting, in hindsight, it seems inevitable now that Duterte would win, but at the beginning, the vice president, Jojo Binay, was the front runner, and he was using this typical pro-poor populist message that Estrada had used. But his opponents effectively tagged him as a trapo, as it's known, a traditional politician. So he was quickly lost popularity. Then came Grace Poe. She's the daughter of the movie star candidate Fernando Poe Jr., who ran in 2004 and was cheated. She seemed to have a strong image as the daughter of this aggrieved presidential candidate who had died of a broken heart, it seemed, and shortly after that election. But she was plagued by citizenship issues. She'd lived in the U.S. She had links to a major tycoon, Eduardo Cuanco, and she had a kind of mixed narrative. She was trying to say, well, I'm sort of a reformist. You can trust me. On the other hand, I do have a heart for the poor, and that mixed message didn't really go over well. Duterte very smartly started his campaign late. He actually substituted his name at the last minute for another party mate, which gave the opposition or the Aquino administration less time to attack him, to undermine his standing. At the very end, they did come up with a scandal, bank account revelations that he had a huge bank account, but this was too little and too late to stop Duterte. And finally, there was the administration candidate himself, Mar Rojas, who promised to continue along the straight path. But that straight path proved to be a dead end. And Duterte very effectively portrayed him as weak and incompetent. Rojas himself was going to rely on traditional machinery. For those of you who know Philippine politics, that's the local mayors and governors and get them to get out voters. But in the end, these political leaders wind up defecting to Duterte, who was surging ahead in the opinion polls. Okay, so what Duterte does during the campaign is offer a kind of neo-authoritarian narrative. And he uses what can be called the Davao model as his calling card. So he was the mayor of Davao, or he had his daughter as mayor for decades. And this was a wild city, lots of crime. The MPA insurgency was very strong in the mid-1980s when he takes over, and yet now it's considered, and Duterte certainly portrays it, as a model city for the Philippines. Peace and order reigns, drug dealers have all been killed, and that's what he says needs to be done in the Philippines as a whole. We have a weak state in the Philippines, he says, leaving citizens defenseless, and this is actually my interpretation. I don't think Duterte himself has said this, but drug dealers are like zombies, right? And for those of you who watch these zombie television shows, apparently there's several ongoing at the moment. When you see a zombie, you just have to kill a zombie, right? So this is what Duterte is saying when it comes to drug pushers. And it's harking back to Marcos's old motto of what the nation really needs is discipline. Democracy is a luxury we really can't afford, showing that he's radicalized this reformist agenda. Also, using his advantages coming from Mindanao, first president from that area, but he's also a Cebuano speaker, the second largest dialect in the Philippines, and of course, as I mentioned earlier, campaigning against the undue influence of Imperial Manila with his lower middle class constituency in urban areas. So this is a diagram that James Putzel put together in an article in a Philippine newspaper. And as you can see, Duterte in the national vote gets a little over 37% of the vote. But in the cities itself, his percentage of the vote goes up to 45%. So the point is that Duterte is particularly strong outside of the traditional rural areas of the Philippines where political machinery is stronger, where his message can get through social media is also more effective. That's where his vote base is strongest. So that's also another important factor in Duterte's success. Then there's the way he talks. There is a song that this cites. And he does, right? He does, that's the way he talks. He brings coarse language, and it's typical of local politics, to the national level. Misogynist jokes, some of you will remember the rape joke. And remember that the joke he's making, I should have been first, is about a woman, a missionary, who's raped and then murdered during a prison outbreak. And he makes a joke about it, and then only partially apologizes. Of course, the xenophobic attacks, the casual cussing. Amplified, of course, by his social media, very militant. Of course, some critics call these supporters of Duterte, Dutertards, showing some of the antagonism that creates. But it underlines for many Filipino voters his determination to bring about what he called real change. And this is where the analogy to Donald Trump may make some sense. He brings this sort of backstage discourse to center stage. To put it in the language of critical discourse analysis and Labov, he does not code shift. We all tend to speak differently in informal settings to formal settings. I'm actually, when I say talk dirty to me, I'm not code shifting properly. So, but that's not my fault. That's Duterte's fault. I have to do this to talk about him. So Duterte doesn't shift. He talks as if he's talking informally, and that gives him a sense of authenticity. He's not speaking like a normal politician, and over, Filipinos were heard to say, we like the fact he swore, because that suggested he was leveling with us. It wasn't just this normal political bullshit that we get. And swearing, of course, was one of the keys, most recently calling the EU F-U, but that's just typical par for the course. So Duterte has stuck to his guns. He's gone about the extrajudicial killings that he promised, that many people thought he actually didn't mean to implement, increasing, this should be police impunity, and weakening already vulnerable institutions. He controls Congress. He's launched personal attacks on his foreign critics, the UN, the U.S. ambassador, and shameful attacks, I think it must be said quite openly, on his leading critic in the Senate, Laila de Lima. If you'll excuse my lack of code switching, he accused Laila de Lima, shock, of having an affair. Duterte himself, of course, is a self-proclaimed womanizer, but that's okay. But she had an affair, and get this, it was with her driver. So not only did she violate, you know, the sanctity, although she was separated, but there's no divorce in the Philippines, so it's not right, but she crossed class lines. Not a good thing. So She not only screwed her driver, Duterte said, she's also screwing the nation because she's not cracking down on drugs like he would. So, you know, he's using this vulgarity, he's using this intimidation to go after his critics, also criticizing, as I mentioned, the church, the courts, the Commission on Human Rights, and, of course, key allies, the U.S., the EU, and, as I said, international institutions. And at the same time, his popularity soars in the idea that constitutional change will take place seemingly likely. And now the issue again of continuismo, in other words, Duterte staying in office beyond his scheduled term, seems to be a real possibility, although he himself, of course, says that he's not interested in staying in power beyond that term. Okay, now here's one thing that I think is important to point out. That is, in the midst of all this controversy around Duterte, thousands of people are being killed. And I couldn't help but think of the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. The Washington Post shows that blacks are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than non-blacks. Of course, the lowest would be among whites, so a clear racial bias in the U.S. But in the Philippines, I would say there's a clear class bias. And one of the media outlets that's done the best job, in my opinion, of covering the Philippines is Al Jazeera. And here, Jamila Alindogan, who has described the war on drugs as a war against the poor. And one vivid illustration is this famous photo by the photographer Rafi Lerma that you may, actually you can't see here, but you may have seen online. It's available at the from the Philippine Daily Inquirer website. It's also been widely shown elsewhere. It shows Jeneline Olares cradling her murdered partner, the pedicab driver, Michael Ciron, Pieta-like, like the great Michelangelo statue. And, of course, in a place like the Philippines, that has a lot of symbolic importance. Thousands of people have been killed without due process, without trial, without any evidence that they're actually guilty. This pedicab driver, Michael Ciron, had a typical cardboard sign around him saying, "I'm a pusher, don't follow what I did." But again, there was no evidence. And then we, of course, we know so-called innocents have been killed, including most recently a 2-year-old child who was killed in one of these encounters, quote-unquote, with criminals. So you have a phenomena of criminalizing the poor. I've already talked about the discipline element of Duterte's regime, the reshuffling of these strategic groups, and also, of course, the foreign policy element, getting rid of those who have used their colonial ties to hold the Philippines down. And this is a very interesting point about Obama's comments, which Jürgen mentioned, Duterte is a colorful guy. For neorealists in international relations, this is a bit of a surprise because they would see a certain continuity of interest that the Philippines has to sort of stick with the U.S. because of China's aggressive stance in the South China Sea. But I would argue this is driven by Duterte's domestic agenda, his illiberal anti-drug crackdown, and of course EU and U.S. criticism of that. But also Duterte has a kind of late 1960s nationalism, which it's important also for winning support in the military and the police where this is widespread and important too in making peace with the Communist Party, and which goes back to his Davao days. He had some encounters with the U.S., also with the FBI. He has a lot of resentments about that, and he's playing into some deep resentments in the Philippines. Philippines is sometimes portrayed as a highly pro-American country, but that's oversimplistic. As Duterte is showing, there are also lots of resentments that he's been playing into very effectively. Finally, is democracy really under threat? And here, one of the most interesting figures on the left is Walden Bello. Some of you will know him, former congressman, activist, author, scholar. He talks about the fact that Duterte has feared not to transgress liberal discourse. That doesn't seem to trouble a significant part of the population. They're even clapping for it, he said. And so even though the regime is not yet electoral authoritarian, elections are still free and fair, the press has not been censored, at least overtly, and although she was removed at the head of a Senate investigation committee, Laila de Lima, although defamed in public, has not yet been jailed, and the courts are not gagged even if they're intimidated. But there's a clear process of democratic deconsolidation going on, attitudinally, behaviorally, and soon institutionally. So the outlook for the Philippines seems to be in the opposite direction of the sort of liberal reformism of the Aquino period. So in sum, what I would argue is you see liberal reformism's decline, the rise of illiberalism, partly due to the internal contradictions of the liberal reformist political order itself, the reliance on patronage despite the good governance discourse. The promise is not of more participation, but of greater efficiency, and when those were not delivered, then the inevitable disappointment, the cheating of pro-poor populists, the overthrow of Estrada, and then the 2004 election in which FPJ was robbed of victory, and now a neo-authoritarian narrative of Duterte drawing on strongman nostalgia for Marcos when, quote, everything was better. It's a radicalized version of reformism without the liberalism that appeals to the middle class. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for a great talk, Mark. We will now open the floor to questions from the audience. We do have a microphone, actually, and we'd like to wait until that gets to you. If you do ask questions, please let us first have your name and affiliation, please. I may also call on you to keep your questions very brief. Thank you. So at the back, there's a lady there, yes.
Hi, yes. My name is Rachelle Vascara. I am a PhD candidate in philosophy at Birkbeck College, and I am also the vice chair of Campaign for Human Rights in the Philippines. So I have three questions, but I'll make myself quick so that other voices can be heard. First of all, I'd like to thank you for organizing this forum. I look around and see so many people who are interested in human rights violations in my country, and I cannot help but feel grateful for this opportunity to raise awareness on human rights violations in the Philippines, here in the UK. It reminded me of the time when I was a student at UC Berkeley when a professor told me that I should be grateful that the U.S. colonized the Philippines because they brought us democracy. And he said I speak proper English because the U.S. was colonized by the Philippines. And my thesis supervisor, Susan James, led me to the philosophy of emotions. I'm interested in the role of passions and emotions in politics. So my first question is, do you think gratitude is the appropriate emotional response for someone like me to someone like you? Second question. In philosophy, we have the notion of an epistemically privileged social location. The idea is that certain people have access to a particular kind of knowledge because of their subjective experiences. So my second question is, to what extent did you consult with Filipinos when you organized this forum about extrajudicial killings in the Philippines? Third question. Extrajudicial killings have been going on in the Philippines for many, many decades. Political activists are harassed, imprisoned, and killed on a daily basis. When the British mining company Glencore wanted to expand their mine, the Philippine military killed Filipino indigenous peoples to advance the interests of a British mining company. I really hope you organize a forum on why the Philippine government killed Filipinos for a British mining corporation, because I think this
Could be more relevant to your third question, because I was just actually hoping you'd ask one, but I will give you the benefit of the doubt and I'll let you ask three. But since there's such a big audience, I would really like to get your third question.
Okay, my apologies. My third question is, do you think there is a morally relevant distinction between the victims of extrajudicial killings of political activists and drug dealers? And why are you organizing this forum just now?
Okay. Yeah, since there's so many questions, I think I should try to answer. First of all, thanks for those comments. I mean, my coming here is thanks to Jürgen. I've been working on the Philippines for 30 years. I think if I had offered a talk like this 10 years ago, there would have been about 10 people here. As I said, it's unfortunate but true that the Philippines has attracted a lot of publicity because of these extrajudicial killings, which is my first comment. Absolutely true. Impunity has been going on for a long time. Lino Broca, the famous Philippine film director who died, sadly, at quite a young age, did a film right after the fall of Marcos, Ora Pro Nobis, talking about the human rights violations occurring already under Cory Aquino. So we do have this history of impunity. I have a PhD student, Danilo Reyes, working on that issue. So the interesting thing is, so this impunity has been going on. There have been extrajudicial killings. They've spiked at certain times. They were particularly high under the Arroyo administration, also high during the Aquino administration. This is the first Aquino administration, Cory Aquino. Of course, there were the journalists killed in 2009, the Ampatuan clan massacre in Mindanao. So there have been a number of high-profile cases, ongoing impunity. That's all true. The interesting thing, though, is now it shifted away from the left, which has been the primary target of these extrajudicial attacks in the past, toward drug dealers.
So that gets to the second question. So should we feel sympathy for the drug dealers? Well, of course, most people don't feel sympathy, and that's part of the right populist appeal. These are criminals. These are zombies. Just kill them, right? But the point is there's no due process. How do we know that these really are drug criminals? And even if they are, I thought this was a health problem. I thought this was something that we should have rehabilitation. In a recent Al Jazeera interview, Duterte admitted they weren't spending money on rehabilitation centers. In other reports that he was having, the 700,000-odd people who had turned themselves in to try to avoid being executed extrajudicially, basically being sent home sometimes after being given a dance class, right? So it's a pretty absurd situation that has attracted a lot of sympathy. One of the very sad things, I think, and Walden Bellow is an important exception, there are other cases, Teddy Casino is another example, who've spoken out from the left and said this is unacceptable, just like they were killing leftists in the past, now they're executing without due process so-called drug criminals. Unfortunately, the left as a whole, which has been very important in protesting against human rights violations in the past, is relatively quiet at the moment, I think clearly due to the fact that Duterte is courting them and trying to do this peace deal and offered a number of cabinet positions. And my friends on the left, and that's the last question, I've been working together with Filipino academics. Obviously, in Duterte's opinion, I'm an SOB who knows very little about the Philippines. So I will accept that, and you take it for what you will. What I'm saying, I'm trying to offer what I think is an analysis of the situation. But I've worked closely with Filipino colleagues. Anybody who knows my work will see that I've co-authored and worked together closely and spend as much time as I can in the Philippines.
Thank you. The next question, there's a hand here to my left, so later your right.
Hello, good evening. So I'm Adrian. I'm a president of the Student Representative Council of the Lawrence School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. I'm also a Filipino. My question is related to democracy. So we have seen the strategic use of democratic channels or privileges to subvert, you know, human rights, such as the freedom of speech through social media to spread disinformation, the use of the democratic mandate of government to avoid due process through extrajudicial killing, and the protection of dynasties and oligarchic structures through Congress, congressional inaction, and anti-dynasty law. So the simple question is democracy broken?
And the simple answer is yes. The question is what should one do about it? And that's, you know, one thing I was trying to get at with this title, Bloody Democracy, because clearly Duterte is using a strong democratic mandate and even stronger public opinion approval as the basis to undermine due process, to basically, you know, send these execution squads out to kill these supposed drug criminals. I agree with that. What one would like, of course, to see is if there is a genuine concern about drugs, to, you know, talk about rehabilitation, to talk about health issues. Also to talk about police impunity, which has been a problem. Talk about military impunity. Deal with extrajudicial killings. Finally deal with some of the crimes of the past. One of the remarkable and sad things about the Philippine transition to electoralism is the lack of a truth commission that's talked about the crimes of the past during the Marcos dictatorship. This is also one of the reasons why it's probably been so easy for Duterte to talk about Marcos in such glowing terms, is the lack of, you know, real dealing with the past, South African style, or to use some of the Latin American cases, where there's been a more intense effort to deal with some of the injustices of the dictatorial past, but also during the democratic, so-called democratic period. So I agree absolutely, but I would argue what Duterte is doing is further undermining already vulnerable institutions. What needs to happen is these institutions need to be strengthened, and it still remains unclear to me how killing people arbitrarily is going to do anything but make things even worse.
Thank you. Yes.
Hello, my name is Carlo, and I just finished my coursework in international relations here at the LSE. I was a student of Dr. Hakim. My question also pertains to democracy, but from a different angle. We all know that democracy is a style of government that has been forged in the West, oftentimes through violent means as well, and later on imposed on a lot of developing countries, including the Philippines. So my question for you is, to what extent do you see democracy in the Philippines itself being renegotiated or sort of like being compromised in such a way that the Filipino people are sort of retaking ownership of their democracy? Do you think that in the end, democracy can be strengthened through this sort of identity crisis, or do you feel that this is a point of no return? Thank you.
I think one would have to be extremely Hegelian to see this as a positive development. Maybe I'm not philosophical enough that there's some sort of profound transformation that will, a synthesis that will occur out of this horrific spate of extrajudicial killings. I mean, if I can say something generally about democracy in the West, one thing I've done in my research is talk about how democracy has its critics also in the West itself. Germany in the 19th century, Imperial Germany, which saw itself as distinct from Britain and France, developed this idea that German culture was not similar to Western civilization, and therefore Western democracy was inappropriate. And this is what Singaporeans picked up. Of course, Singapore is an electoral authoritarian regime, the People's Action Party, an authoritarian political order, despite holding relatively free elections, not fair, however. So this is a common discourse of dictators, right, to justify authoritarianism. So one has to be clear that even though it's true that there's this, you know, imposition, particularly in the Philippine case, I talked about it, it's colonial democracy. It goes back to American colonialism in the early 20th century. That's clear, that's true, but there's also this aspect of the instrumentalization of an anti-Western discourse to justify a dictatorship. And I see Duterte doing that. Clearly, he's playing this anti-colonial card. I don't doubt his sincerity, and of course, some of the things he said are absolutely true. Held up these pictures at the ASEAN summit where Obama was attending, you know, about the massacres that the U.S. Committed in Mindanao. All true. But of course, for what purpose is he using this, justifying his anti-drug crackdown? So I don't know if I can see any sort of larger change in terms of Philippine democracy, but it certainly is a kind of crisis of Philippine democracy, without doubt.
Okay, then we have a gentleman here on the right.
Thank you, Professor. My name is Jack Wagner. I work for a risk management firm here in Asia on Asian intelligence. I have a few questions, but I'll focus it on business because a lot of our clients that we work with are very concerned about this. So firstly, what do you see the effect of this being on business confidence? And do you foresee any actual change to the business environment from this crime crackdown? And related to that, part of his drug crackdown is on corrupt politicians. And do you see that more as getting rid of his political opponents? Thanks.
Well, just to answer the last point, thanks for that question. It's unclear if he's really cracking down on corrupt politicians. He's accused a few people who could be considered political enemies of being drug dealers. I talked about Lila de Lima, who's also the former mayor of Cebu, who's been accused of this. But I don't see any major crackdown on corruption yet. He has promised that he hasn't started it yet. He's no Xi Jinping, that's for sure. What we see is really an exclusive focus on the drug crackdown. The former president, Fidel Ramos, recently said, don't we have other problems? Isn't there poverty still and other issues like this? It's kind of a monomaniacal focus on the drug problem, which he's been exaggerating. The statistics have been kind of faked, as some the Center for Philippine Journalism has pointed out, to justify this crackdown. Will it affect business? Well, of course, on the surface, no, because even though Duterte talks about stronger social programs, which is clearly a good thing, he's also talking about preserving these macroeconomic fundamentals, which has been part of the Philippine success story over the last three decades, and encouraging foreign investment. Very interesting sort of contradiction to this left agenda, opening up the country for foreign trade through constitutional change. At the moment, foreign investment is limited by a constitutional provision, so he wants to change that. He's also promised to maintain the economic fundamentals. So on the surface, no. The question is whether this kind of drug crackdown gets out of control. Clearly, it's not affecting foreigners. It's affecting the Philippine poor, basically, as I said. Even those rich Filipinos, the police knock politely and ask, can we please talk to you about drugs? In poor areas, they tend to come in with the guns blazing, right? So for the average business person in Makati or another business center of Manila, you don't see a real change. But it's certainly attracting a lot of bad publicity and has made some foreign investors jumpy. The peso has fallen recently. I attribute that to this worry about the Philippines. But at least Duterte himself seems determined to make it an environment friendly to foreign investment. And, of course, one of the advantages of rebalancing toward Beijing is to get more Chinese investment, which seems likely and, again, would help the economy.
Okay. Yes, right next to you, Leigh, there's a lady there.
Hi. I'm Sheila Thielen, a founding member of the Filipino Domestic Workers Association, a self-help group that campaigns for the rights of migrant domestic workers here in Manila. My question is, as experts on the Philippines, what do you think is the role of Western human rights groups, Western media, and Western governments when there is human rights violations happening in a sovereign country? Should foreign governments interfere with national issues of a sovereign country? Thank you.
Well, I can answer that question very easily. If one takes Duterte's position, the answer is clearly no. And those SOBs should just stop it. If you believe in something called universal human rights, I think you certainly should speak out. And that's what people have been doing in the past when leftists have been killed. And that's what they're now doing when so-called supposed drug criminals are being killed. Now they're being criticized. Before, the left was supporting them. It depends on your perspective. I certainly am an old-fashioned believer in universal human rights, for which I don't wish to apologize.
Okay, at the far end over there, sort of. Yes. Can you please wait for the microphone? Thank you.
I'm a scholar at St. Anthony's in Oxford, and I have worked in rural areas in the Philippines for 25 years in medical care. And I'm glad that somebody brought up medical side of drug addiction. And I'm very concerned. There are two issues here. One is drug dealers. But the drug consumers almost always come from broken families, dysfunctional families. No one is talking about doing an appraisal about why such a lot of people are using drugs. Are you going to bump them off? And then the new generation of drug users will come up because the root problem has not been solved. And I am a cleft surgeon. And almost always when I see a poor cleft child who has never had a cleft repaired, it's because there is no father or mother who has no money to pay. And second, believe me or not, I have done more than 3,000 free cleft lip and palate surgery in many, many rural areas free of charge. There are many dysfunctional problems in families. This is the fundamental cause of drug luring. So dealing with drug lords or drug business guys who are bringing in drugs is a different story altogether. And the second part, has it ever been analyzed where these drugs are coming from? I want to ask anyone in this room to tell me where these drugs are coming from. Please, anyone can tell me. I know the answer. These drugs come from China, through Afghanistan, through Pakistan. And I'm telling you,
okay.
I know many drug users who are from broken families. Mm. I pity them because they are helpless.
Would you like to add another question? Or
no.
I just
finish by saying.
Okay.
What we have to address is sympathetically give us to create an awareness why are there so many drug users.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I certainly agree with that. Just one interesting comparison. Thailand had a violent crackdown on drugs in 2003 under the rule of Thaksin Shinawat. And there had been several studies done. First of all, about half of those killed, about 3,000 were not even linked to the drug trade. So there are probably a lot of people being killed right out in the Philippines, not due to any links to drugs, but due to political vendettas. There's the list being put together in very arbitrary manners. But, you know, now Thailand, somewhat ironically under a military regime, is in fact treating drug abuse as a health problem. So they had their phase of violent crackdown. Now they've come to the conclusion that it is a health problem. They're looking at rehabilitation. One can only hope that realization comes to Philippine authorities as well soon.
Okay, we have a question here right in the front.
Yeah, hi, Professor. My name's Aaron. I go to King's College London as a street. I'm just wondering, do you think there's a parallel to be made between the idea that the war on drugs is basically a war against the poor, as there was with how, during the Nixon regime, the war on drugs, in retrospect, was a war against basically ethnic minorities, namely black people?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. So you can go beyond my analogy with Black Lives Matter to back to the war on drugs. And I agree absolutely that, if you look at incarceration rates among African Americans, a lot of that has to do with the war on drugs. And, of course, also this, you know, this modus vivendi of the modus operandi is what I'm trying to say of you know, just basically shooting first, asking questions later, also comes out of this period where the American police have militarized. So, yeah, that's a good addition to the point. So I'm saying you see this in the U.S., and what I would, what I've been looking for is a poor Filipino Lives Matter movement, right? Just like the Black Lives Matter movement is mobilizing, rightly so, what about somebody speaking up for those poor Filipinos being shot in this drug crackdown?
Okay. Yes. Gentleman there, right in the middle.
Thank you. My name is Andres, master's student here at LSE. My question is about, I'm just wondering how useful the terms populism and populist are as to like terms of analysis in politics in general, but more specifically in the Philippines. Because you seem, well, my understanding from the presentation is that you seem to talk about populist as like a particular phenomenon, but also most of the politicians talked about are fall under this category. So I'm just wondering what a non-populist looks like and how is that different and therefore requires like it being treated as a different phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, in this sense, I mean, certainly, as I said, it's an impressionistic term. It's all very problematic, and it's not my sort of first choice in political analysis. But I have to say, after having read the populism literature generally and about the Philippines in particular, there is a certain degree of usefulness, and that's what I've tried to present here. And certainly the left-right distinction, as problematic as it is in Duterte's case, seems to make sense in terms of, you know, seeing the elite allied with this vicious minority, the drug dealers, right? And so you can signal them out, single them out, what I'm trying to say, like you do migrants, say, in Europe as the cause of societal problems and so on. Make them the scapegoats, right? If you look at the last election, I think it's clear Duterte was the only really successful populist. Binay did try to use what I would call left populism, but that was undermined by these accusations that he's just a traditional politician. He also ran a horrible campaign. I mean, just everything. His campaign was almost worse than Donald Trump's. It was just terrible. Just made all sorts of mistakes. And Binay's a decent guy who did a good job as mayor of Makati, in my opinion, but had this horrible reputation, didn't deal with the scandal issues well, didn't come across as an effective candidate, and so his populism, basically, his populist appeal failed. Rojas, a traditional political elite, zero charisma, just talking sort of in a sort of robotic fashion about continuing the straight path, and was easily portrayed by Duterte as weak and incompetent, right? Grace Poe, passive, even though Duterte is making misogynist comments, rape jokes, doesn't even call him to task for it, just ran also a very poor campaign, lack of any sort of charisma, and lack of any clear message that could be considered populist. So I think that campaign shows us that in that sense, Duterte managed to package his message in a populist fashion, and that proved to be extremely effective.
We have a gentleman standing against that wall.
Hi there, yes. First of all, I'd like to congratulate you on your talk. My name is Michael. I'm a final year undergraduate here at LSE. I'm currently drafting the constitution for the first ever Filipino society at LSE. So again, I'd like to say thank you for coming to speak to us. Also, thank you for concisely informing everyone, maybe the impression that a lot of my friends have of Duterte is he's that guy that called Obama a son of a whore, which any Tagalog speakers in the room will actually know that I'm not going to say it because my mum's going to listen to this podcast, but the interjection that was used is actually just an interjection. He was not directly calling Obama a son of Obama. Sorry, Mum. But yes, on that point, you mentioned that Al Jazeera was a trusted source of yours. I also agree. I tend not to trust the local media, whether they're for him or against him. They're all a bit hypocritical, in my opinion. Al Jazeera did a pretty good job of staying quite neutral and factual. But my question is on that point. Duterte has said very often that he doesn't care about the media. And in this day and age, at least in this country, the influence of social media and media over politics is said to be extremely important. My question to you is, what potential do you think the media and social media has to affect the reign of Duterte? Obviously, it's affected his international image, you know. Most people, you know, if they've heard of Duterte, like I said, he's the guy who said this about Obama or F you to the EU. But what concrete effects do you think it might have on the Philippines and its people?
Thanks. Number of good points. Somewhat difficult to answer, although, of course, in terms of international media, you're right, it's almost universally critical. Philippine press is more complicated. I would defend the Philippine press. Philippine Daily Inquirer has done a very good job. Also Rappler, very important source of information. Duterte apparently hates Rappler, so I think we should praise Rappler as a decent source of information. The Philippine PCIJ, Philippine Center for Investigative Journalism, is also doing an excellent job. It's one of the sources that's pointed out that Duterte's numbers, drug numbers, 3 million addicts, doesn't add up. The Philippine Drug Agency itself says it's more like 1.5 million. So they're doing a good job. Social media, of course, has been something that's helped Duterte during the campaign, and more recently, you know, Duterte himself doesn't really do much on social media, but his supporters are very active. So there's been a lot of cyberbullying. Laila De Lima has been complaining a lot about the way she's being bullied. Her address and telephone number and so on were revealed in these House investigations. So you know that's quite negative. It's a mixed picture overall.
Yes, the next person to ask a question would be the lady over here.
Hi, good evening. My name is Hannah, and I study also at King's College London. I am president of the Aunt Society there. My question is, in your talk, you did touch on the appeal of Duterte and the brand that he presented, which obviously led to his last side win. Given your understanding and obviously the way that things are going now with the EGKs, do you think that his appeal will continue to be longstanding among the Filipino people, or how would you see his future in his term?
Very interesting question, hard to answer, obviously. His popularity has already declined slightly, although it's still very high. My sense is that, one thing that surprised me is we have had a number of high-profile killings where, you know, it's pretty obvious that innocent, quote-unquote, innocent people have been killed, and there's not been a lot of outrage. Because, you know, Duterte said about this picture, this photograph I showed, people are dramatizing things, you know, and of course there's going to be collateral damage when we crack down on drugs. So people are accepting that. The other graph I showed you that showed Filipinos' concern with crime has decreased recently, and now it's, you know, wages and so on. I think that is the potential to undermine Duterte's least sky-high popularity, as people are starting to ask, but what about endo? For those of you who know the Philippines, the terrible problem of these short-term contracts, which end after 6 months, right? Duterte talked about that. This goes back to the business question, but some of his business allies are saying, no, we need these short-term contracts, right? What about that? What about wages? What about inflation? What about poverty? What about, you know, these other issues that matter? Is it really just all about drug dealers and drug users, and what about the innocents? So I think if Duterte, you know, he initially promised to do this within 3 to 6 months. Now he's asking for an extension. And so, you know, I think one of his major allies is Fidel Ramos still, and he's also becoming critical. So I think we could see a turning point if he continues to be so obsessed with this. The other thing, of course, is there may be international investigations. Laila De Lima has said the International Court of Justice will come after you. And I think that's probably true. Duterte has promised to allow international human rights groups to come into the Philippines, but then we find out that they actually have not received any formal invitation. So there are a lot of things that potentially could happen to him. But it's hard to predict, and his popularity does at this moment remain high.
I'm wondering whether I could just abuse the position of chair for a second and ask you as to whether you could say something more on President Duterte's perspective on the United States.
Well, as I said, it's important to understand Duterte studied in Manila, even though he's from Mindanao, he studied in Manila in the late 60s, early 70s. There was a so-called, some people have been calling it Diliman nationalism. Diliman is where the University of the Philippines is located in Quezon City, and it's sort of this nationalist narrative. Bonifacio is the true hero of the Philippines, not this writer Jose Rizal or this elite General Aguinaldo. It was Bonifacio who was this proletariat. Actually not true, it turns out, but never mind. That's part of the narrative. And it raises issues about American colonialism and so on. So, you know, I think that's genuine. And obviously, as I said, what a lot of what Duterte says about the U.S. is absolutely true. The only question, of course, is why now, right? What is the reason for bringing this up now? It's part of this narrative that he has had since he was a student. It's part of his resentments toward the U.S. when he was mayor of Davao. But it also serves his interest because it helps deflect these, you know, concerns about human rights violations. And, of course, it's not just the U.S. It's also the EU and the UN and anybody else who dares criticize his violent crackdown on drugs. So I think it's a mixture of motivations that come together. But I think he does feel some genuine resentments toward the U.S., and those resentments, it turns out, are shared by many Filipinos as well. I should add that Joseph Estrada, who I mentioned in passing, was toppled, also had these sentiments. He didn't bring them out quite as strongly, but he was opponent of the U.S. bases, which were successfully removed in 1992. Now U.S. forces have come back a little, although much smaller numbers than before. So this has been there was also a strong nationalist narrative in the 1950s. Recto was an important politician who articulated this. So, you know, there's this tradition of nationalism which Duterte has brought back. It resonates well and, of course, serves his interests in a number of ways.
Okay. Yes, there's a gentleman here. Okay, can we actually now collect some questions?
Sure.
Because we're running short of time. Yeah, sort of. There's one here. Sort of the next one will then be back over there.
But he already asked. Maybe we should.
Oh, okay. I didn't see that. Let him ask anyway. Yeah. There's a lady standing over there, and then the gentleman over here. Yeah, and we'll collect.
Can I take them first?
Yeah.
Any which way.
Sorry for asking a second one. Just to follow up on that, do you see a sort of parallel between Duterte and Trump in the sense that it seems that that Trump says the first thing that comes to his mind and doesn't really when he says things, it's just off the cuff. In a way, Duterte has sort of done the same thing, and his, you know, foreign minister and his other administrators have come out afterwards saying, oh, no, wait a second, that's not what he meant. He did that when he threatened to leave the UN, and then they said, no, we're actually not going to leave the UN. So do you think that he actually, you know, thinks about what he says beforehand, or is he sort of just crazy?
Thank you.
Thanks. My name is Sharma, student at King's College London. My question is, do you think Duterte's style could be mimicked, albeit to a lesser extent, by other democratic leaders in the region as they're looking for popular support? And the person I have in mind is Jokowi in Indonesia, who recently spoke of castrating pedophiles.
Thank you. And then back. The lady just over there. That's right.
Hi. Thank you for the speech. I know nothing about Philippine politics now. I know so much more. And I have a few questions. The first one is the drug addiction question in the Philippines. So I feel like, from what you describe, I feel like Philippines is a person who is a drug addict now, and Duterte is trying to take away the drugs and then trying to deal with the affect by trying to boost up the economy. Do you think if he doesn't do it so harshly, what can Filipinas do in a soft, what can Filipinas do? Like using the way that treating it as a health problem, that gentle way, or anything else they can do to deal with this drug problem?
And okay, sorry, I have to limit you to one question as there are other people in the room who would still like to ask questions later on. So if we give the speaker a chance to respond to those three questions and then we'll sort of collect another set.
Thanks for those questions. Briefly to Trump, I mean, I didn't want to overdo the analogy. Duterte is not an idiot. Duterte, there's a method to his madness. He's not a chronic narcissist. He's not a, you know, his misogyny seems to be limited to verbal remarks, as far as we can tell. He's just totally different classification of person. He's an experienced politician. You know, he's clearly emotional and says things off the cuff and uses this code-switching trick that Trump uses, but a very different kind of person and therefore, in a sense, much more dangerous because he's very serious about what he's doing and, you know, he doesn't spend evenings going off on, attacks on beauty queens. When he attacks a woman, he'll attack his chief opponent, Laila de Lima, and that viciously, but of course, because she represents a real danger to him. The Jokowi comparison is interesting. He has, however, been called a polite populist. And even though castration is not a very polite thing to do, and of course capital punishment is very important in his anti-drug crackdown, he's been more limited, more constrained. You know, there's some interesting similarities in terms of this also being a local politician, having sort of this populist sense of the people, seeing himself as distinguished from the traditional elite, but certainly not nearly as radical as Duterte is in this aggressive anti-drug stance, which brings me to the final question about drugs. That is my point. I mean, clearly the Philippines has a major drug problem. It may have been underestimated. Duterte may have been right about that. As was talked about earlier, supplies from China, but also these meth labs for Shabu in the Philippines, as the drug is called, crystal meth. But nonetheless, you know, it's unclear how just simply killing supposed drug dealers and users is going to in any way solve this problem, and it's distracting from more important issues.
Thank you. I think there were two further questions. I saw a hand go up in this part of the room, and then there were two more hands sort of in the other part. So, yes, I think the lady has the microphone. Yes, thanks.
I just wondered, you were mentioning a lot about, I'm doing IMA at University College London. I was just wondering, right, you were talking about nationalism quite a lot. I was wondering, is there like a racialized element to the drug campaign that he's doing, or is it, because I know that he came from a part of the country where there's never before been a president from that area, and I know also from what I've read that he's quite popular with a lot of ethnic minorities in the Philippines. Is there like a minority that has become linked to drugs, or is he just literally trying to go after anyone that he thinks is linked to it?
Okay, thank you for that question. And then over there, yes. There's one, yeah. It's fine.
Hi, my name is Darren Deutsch. I'm an MSc student at the LSE. And so listening to your speech is very interesting. And I have questions like, do you think that the Filipino voters are likely to vote for him more if he kills more Zimbu? Like, there's more human rights violations, killing people, extra, you know, court like this. Or maybe he used like more vulgar statement, curse the U.S. president. And do you think that Filipino like this kind of politician?
Okay, thank you for that question. And then there's a lady standing right next to you there. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, my name is Jordana. I'm a PhD student here at LSE. And I've actually just come back from field work in Cebu, where I was working with urban poor communities. And I just wanted your reflections on one of my observations that was fed back to me through the field, where a lot of the communities that are really affected by issues of drugs and general states of insecurity, including police brutality associated with drug mobs, they spoke to me very consciously, recognizing that this was sort of a war on the poor and on their communities. But in the same token, they were saying what an impact they had noticed on the ground of Duterte's campaign. Like, they found the Tokangyo program really successful. It drove out a lot of people that they considered to be dangerous in the community, and that made their day-to-day living really difficult and made them really afraid. And I just wanted your reflections on that.
Thanks very much. If I can start with the last question first, I think that's very important. She was referring to this knock and question principle. So the police go around and they knock on people's doors and try to find out who's doing the drug dealing. Yeah, sure. You may know the work of Nicole Corrato. She's just come out with a piece. It's now online, Journal of Contemporary Asia, which she also draws on ethnological field work. Ethnography. She's talking to people in Leyte, victims of the typhoon, but also with this drug problem coming in, and you'd get that. There's also interesting evidence from field work that's been done in Jakarta, similar situation with killings of supposed drug dealers. Sure, there's a lot of sympathy for that. When I was in Manila recently, taxi drivers are saying things are better, right, and we've gotten rid of the bad guys. But, you know, as the gentleman who spoke earlier said, the question is, how sustainable is this, right? In Thailand, again, this has been studied, the 2003 violent crackdown, the study concluded that crime stayed down for about a year. So you're killing all these innocent people, and in the Thai case, as I said, it's important to point out half of them turned out to have nothing to do with drugs, right? So a lot of quote-unquote innocents are getting killed in the process. Doesn't seem to have a long-term benefit, and there's now recognition in Thailand that it's actually a health problem. But in the short run, sure, people are, if there's a big bag drug dealer around the corner and the police kill him, or presumably him or her, occasionally, then it's a good thing. But, let's ask them in 5-10 years whether they see that is sustained. And in the meantime, let's talk about all the funerals going on for, you know, and all these people have families and the suffering they've gone through. So that it's certainly complicated, but that's certainly a finding that's come out and one thing that sustains the support for this in the country. Is it racialized? No, it's class. It's really class. The Philippines has some racial dimensions, has some religious differences in the south with Islam, which is, by the way, one of Duterte's other strengths. He seems to be much more understanding of this. He claims to have Muslim background and part of his family. That's one advantage of Mindanao. It's much more attuned to some of these diversities of the Philippines. So one certainly can accuse Duterte of prejudice against Islam, although actually one accusation was made during these hearings, but I won't go into that. But basically open-minded toward that. Also no sign of as you say, he's befriended ethnic minorities, which are also prevalent in Mindanao. So that's not the issue. My question is one of criminalizing the poor, which I've already mentioned. And is that popular? Is that other question? Yes, it is popular because people do have the perception that the bad guys are getting killed. And as long as they have that perception, I think this is going to continue to be popular.
Okay, I'm afraid we are now out of time. It's really been a great pleasure for me, and I think for all of us here, to have had the opportunity to listen to Professor Mark Thompson discussing the nature of President Duterte's approach to politics and how we can make sense of this. I'm also very grateful really to you for accommodating us, given your very busy schedule whilst you are in London, and I think I hope you will join me here in extending my thanks to Professor Thompson in the usual way. Thank you very much for coming.